The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On October 20th, 2010, Dr. Colin Bradford, a leading voice on the new dynamics of summetry, spoke to the Korea Society about final preparations and innovations for the upcoming G20 meeting of world leaders. He discussed Korean hopes for the summit and comparative approaches for several issues, highlighting Korea as a regional hub for economic dialogue, investment, and innovation.
Thank you for joining us in the Samsung Center for Intercultural Exchange and joining us via podcast courtesy of the Tongyang Group. I'm Stephen Nerper, Senior Vice President of the Korea Society. We've launched an exciting season in policy, both business and public, and the arts, and refer you to our events-filled calendar at www.koreasociety.org. The Korea Society business programs this year have featured Mark Nolan of the Peterson Institute of International Economics, Vice Minister Herkyung-wook of Korea's Ministry of Strategy and Finance, Henry Siegerman, who's here with us today, of the Korea International Investment Fund, Scott Kalb of the Korea Investment Corporation, and Bank of Korea Governor Kim Chung-soo, among several others. A special thanks to Natalie of our program staff and to Peter of our media team for their kind facilitation and sterling efforts this morning. This executive breakfast is the final in a three-part series highlighting Korea's attractiveness as a regional hub for economic dialogue, investment, and innovation. This session explores bringing the world to Korea for the G20 summit and comparative innovations. Today, we welcome back on the line Colin Bradford, a leading voice on the new dynamics of summetry and innovations for this G20 summit. Dr. Bradford is a non-resident senior fellow, Global Economy and Development at the Brookings Institution, and a senior fellow at the Center for Global Governance Innovation. A former chief economist at the U.S. Agency for International Development, Colin focuses on global economic governance, environmental governance, and international economics and development. Colin has been a leading figure in mobilizing professional opinion and policy attention on the importance of the G20. In the mid-1990s, he was a leader in articulating the need for a post-Cold War vision for development cooperation by developing the International Development Goals, the IDGs, and the OECD Development Assistance Committee, and in promoting a consensus around them. In 2003, he played a pivotal role in transforming the IDGs and the Millennium Declaration goals into a single vision, which we know today as the Millennium Development Goals. He was an advisor to the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Helsinki process on the MDGs in the 2000s. A bit earlier in the 1980s, while at Yale, Dr. Bradford played a key role in the international debate regarding the East Asian miracles, including Korea. Dr. Bradford has focused his professional life as an international economist on the relationship of developing countries to the world economy, serving 10 years in the U.S. government, 8 in international institutions, and 16 years in universities, including American University, Georgetown, and Johns Hopkins SAIS. He was a presidential appointee in the Clinton administration, where he was chief economist of USAID, a political appointee in the Carter administration, where he was head of the Office of Multilateral Development Banks in the U.S. Treasury, and a legislative assistant for U.S. Senator Lawton Shiles. He held senior economic policy positions in the OECD in Paris, the World Bank, and the Inter-American Committee for the Alliance for Progress. He holds a BA in history from Yale University and a PhD in economics from our friends up the road at Columbia University. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you, Stephen. Nice to be here. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you. We really appreciate the effort you put in our opening session. We're delighted to have you back for our closing session. And we know that in the ensuing month, there may well have been some progress as we've moved closer to the start of the November Seoul Summit. And we'd like to invite you to explore a bit more the innovations that you began with in the first session and other ideas in terms of comparative innovations in the region.
Fine. Well, Stephen, thank you, and thank everybody who's there and online for your interest in Korea and its, and particularly the G20 summit and the role, the key role, really, that Korea is playing, leadership role that Korea is playing now in a very difficult moment, which I'll return to in a minute. But let me just say, I just came back from Korea, where we did at the end of September a two-day symposium that was sponsored by the G20 committee, Presidential Committee of Korea on the G20. Sakong Il is the chair of that. We did it with the G20 committee, with the Korean Development Institute, and Dong-Al Ilbo, the oldest newspaper in Korea, which you all know better than I, I'm sure. So it was a large event with 600 people there, and we brought 30 people from around the world to bring some focus to bear on some of the key issues. I guess the thing, having been in Korea for 8 days then, and for a week in May, and then for a few days in November, three times within the last year, I got a chance this time to do a little bit more than I had been able to do, thanks to a Chilean friend of mine who was a part of the conference. We explored a bit Korea, Seoul especially, but also outside of Seoul. And I guess I've written more about Korea, I think, in the 80s and 90s than I've written about any other country. And even though I hadn't spent much time there, there was a huge debate then about the East Asian models, as Stephen said in the introduction. And what is stunning, you know, later, some years later, is to realize, and this was said over and over again in the big G20 International Symposium, which we did the end of September, was emphasized by other people such as Paul Martin, the former Prime Minister of Canada, who was with us there, that, you know, when you look back on the last 50 years, and I don't need to tell all of you, you know this as well, better than anybody else, but is that if you look back on the last 50 years, Korea transformed itself in a way that we think no other country in history has ever done. And it's palpable when you're on the ground in Seoul. It's palpable when you travel around the country and see the infrastructure investment that's necessary to integrate the market economy of South Korea. It's evident when you see the architecture. It's evident when you realize, I was out in Colorado this weekend, you pick up the newspaper and there's an article. It's actually an advertisement, it turned out, but it's an article that basically says that, you know, the Hyundai automobile is one of the best automobiles on the road, and you know, you look it up on the online, and you find you can get a large SUV with three tiers of seats for $28,000. When if you bought the alternative, you know, a Lexus or an Audi or a Volvo, you'd pay $48,000. So, you know, I have full confidence in the engineering and the quality of Korean products. And what you realize is that as you get to know Korea more, and this is something that we actually said in the 1980s and early 90s when we were debating all this, is that Korea had a very different approach, as you know, to dynamic development than other countries. And you see it today. I mean, you see it in the debate in one of the Korean English newspapers. There was a discussion about how to go about greening the economy of Korea, and one of the ways that they've thought to do it is the way they did it in the first place, which is to cluster economic activities in a specific geographic area so that you get synergies. I mean, there's this, you know, this old story about Korean development in the 80s, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s being built on steel cars and ports and ships, steel cars and ships. And obviously, there's just obvious synergy amongst those, and you gain economies of scale, and you gain interactive economies by strategically developing sectors that complement each other and generate you know, positive sum outcomes out of that kind of interaction. So, and you look at Buddhism, and I bought a book on Buddhism, and it makes it very clear that first of all, Korea has a unique way of formulating Buddhism, and second of all, that uniqueness comes from its holistic approach, its ability to integrate a variety of different Buddhisms from around the world into a uniquely Korean one, which doesn't favor one tradition over another, but rather pulls them all together in a pluralistic way. Similar to, you could say intellectually, to the clustering idea in a way. Mm-hmm. Bringing complementary things together and making something still better out of a holistic approach rather than keeping them segmented and separated and specialized as you would do in the West. So basically, in a few words, I'm just trying to say that one grasps, you know, almost gasps at the manifestations of modernity and hyper growth in Seoul and Korea in general. One realizes the stunning achievement that this country has made. One realizes that the unique view that and culture and intellectual perspective that drove this dynamic development over the last 50 years, which is quite different really than the standard Western Anglo-Saxon economic formulations. Mm-hmm. And you realize how Korea can contribute in this moment of not only great financial and economic crisis, but also at this moment in the early 21st century when different cultures, the major countries that are coming together in the G20 represent very diverse civilizations, not just cultures, but civilizations. And so Korea is uniquely placed, it seems to me, being successful economically and having a kind of very interesting integrative approach to culture, is in a very unique place to play a role as a convener and leader and host to the G20 summit in Seoul. Now, unfortunately, and I'll pause here to get you involved in the conversation, but unfortunately, even this morning, if you read the Financial Times, there are two articles on the fact that there's an incredible amount of dissension and conflicting views within the G20 grouping of countries about how to rebalance the global economy and how to move forward, in fact, in a coordinated way. And I'll discuss that. But I just thought I'd, Stephen, just pause for a second to see if people who know Korea much better than I actually have any comments or questions or discussion they want to make about what I've said initially.
I think you've actually just hit on one of the pressing issues that's on a lot of our minds here at the table today. So maybe you could continue, because that really is a dominant theme that's emerged in the last few weeks.
Yeah. Well, you know, let me just, for those of you who haven't seen the Financial Times, let me just read you two articles. Front page, above the fold, India in warning on G20 tensions. Page 4, Alan Beattie, who we had in Korea with us at the international symposium that I mentioned that we just organized at the end of September, and Song Jung-ah writes from Korea, doubts grow over prospects for G20. Unilateral actions to counter global imbalances continue to spread. This is not news to me. I mean, I was dithering on the plane on the way home about trying to figure out the way out of this mess. I mean, the currency war has been declared between the U.S. and China. There's just, there's just a tremendous feeling that instead of, and I've discussed, you know, we've discussed this with Alan Beattie before, the Financial Times guy before, is, you know, we've had conflicts in the run-up to the London summit between the U.K. and the U.S. on the one side and the continental Europeans on the other about the degree to which all countries needed to engage in expansionary monetary and fiscal policy. We had a similar conflict between, as it turns out, G7 countries still again about both financial regulatory reform and expansionary policies and exit strategies in the run-up to the Toronto summit in June, where, you know, Canada was saying we didn't have a financial problem, so you know, we're not as strong to push regulatory reform as, say, the U.S. and the U.K. and others are, and where you had differences again about, you know, exit strategies with Merkel not wanting to wind back on her, what little expansionary efforts they did make, and again the U.S. wanting to push forward. Mm-hmm. So you know, this is not the first time, but this is a little more serious, I'll have to say. I mean, it turns out that the Brazilians, I can't understand why Lula's doing this. The Brazilians are pulling their finance minister and central bank president are not going to the G20 finance ministers meeting this week, the FT announced this morning. So, and the Indians are sounding very pessimistic indeed. Singh himself said something. Let's see if I can find the quote quickly. Singh said, "I'm worried about the global situation." And his staff, his advisors elaborated and said there's no agreement on diagnosis. We've lost consensus about how to tackle the situation. That's my worry about the Seoul conference. The G20 is in serious difficulty. That's from an Indian. So there's a problem. My view is that the way around it, I've been doing some numbers. Let me just try the numbers out on you. If the thesis that I would like to put forward to the Koreans is, look, the play you should make is to get the mid-sized emerging market economies to pull together in expansionary policies. So by mid-sized, I mean, you've got to leave. What's the goal? The goal is to diffuse the currency war by having other countries in the G20 act in such a way that it takes the heat off away from the pressure on the U.S. and China to be the motors for growth in the world economy. Now, that's difficult to do because at the very least, I haven't looked this up quite yet. I'll do it today. But my recollection is that China and the U.S. together could be as much as 40% of the world economy. So if that's true, then it's a little bit difficult to figure out how to do it. But if you do, I don't know whether you can follow this over the phone or not, but if the U.S. and China are 40% and the G20 is 85% of the world economy, 40% of 85% is 35 percentage points. So 35 percentage points minus 85 means that the rest of the G20 is 50% of the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you roughly say, okay, of that 50% of the world economy, let's say I think it's possible that the other emerging market economies, the nine other emerging market economies, namely India, Indonesia, Korea, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico, are roughly 30 percentage points of that 50%, and that the other G8 countries, the other eight advanced industrial countries are, say, 20% percentage points. So if the mid-sized emerging market members of the G20 are 30% of the world economy, if they grew 3.3 percentage points faster than they might have otherwise by stimulating their economies, they could add 1%, 3.3 times 30% of the world GDP, they could add one percentage point to GDP growth by stimulating. So, and 30% really isn't that far from the 40% that the U.S. and China represent. So the point I'm trying to get at is, and I will confirm these figures today, is that roughly that, you know, the mid-sized economies, the non-giant economies, although you'd have a little trouble, I think, saying India is not a super power, and maybe Brazil too, but still, for the moment, just for the argument, let's just say the nine emerging market economies swing quite a bit of weight if they pull together. So, and if they could generate a significant, the good news is that they carry enough weight to offset or play a role in stimulating the world economy that is getting close to being equivalent to the U.S. and China together.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the bad news is that 3.3 percentage points is a lot of expansionary effort, incremental effort to make in order to get it to goose world GDP by 1%. So, you know, there are some problems with the number, and I haven't quite been able yet, because I didn't have any data with me yesterday on the airplane, of course, so to figure out the trade effects of this. But in any case, I mean, I think it seems plausible, or at least certainly worth exploring, whether or not Korea is a mid-sized economy and probably ranking, 10th or 12th in the world as in terms of GDP. along with us eight others, could provide some real economic leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And it could take the pressure, and that would be in the, I think the other thing, just to quickly say, is that you wouldn't have that as the sole pillar, but it also, of course, would give the G20 a huge boost, because, I mean, then you'd have a successful strategy. You'd have the smaller countries in the large country grouping playing a role together. You know, Australia and Canada might join in. They're mid-sized economies too. And, you know, you could get something going perhaps on that. But I think the other thing to do that I've urged before and I will urge again is this global imbalance problem is not going to get resolved in Seoul, except if Seoul is able to communicate to the world and that the government, the leaders there agree to it, including Lula, who is going out as leader. And I would expect, the only thing I can figure out is why Lula's keeping his minister and president of central bank home from the G20 finance ministers meeting this week is because he wants to make a play himself, I'm hoping.
Mm-hmm.
Seoul. And because otherwise it looks nasty. I mean, the world's in a problem. You know, Singh saying the world's got a problem, he's right. There is a problem. That's evident to everybody who's watching it. So what you do is you go and you try to solve it. You don't stay home. I mean, I really don't understand this move on the Brazil. I'm a big fan of Lula's, and I think he's been a terrific leader. I think it's sad he has to leave the global, you know, the global stage. But it's an odd move, I have to say, coming from him. And he did stay home from Toronto, you remember. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the reasons he might have done that, as we may have discussed in the breakfast earlier in the fall, was the business with Iran. And he didn't want to take flack from the others. So it's not quite clear to me what kind of a game he's playing. But that maybe is a diversion. I think the thing to say is that in Seoul, the leaders need to themselves unite around a reassuring message to the world that, yes, there are conflicts today. Yes, there are imbalances today. But we are putting in place a process within this framework of strong, sustainable, and balanced growth within the G20, which is a five-year outlook. You know how this works, is that the governments are meant to submit to the IMF trajectories over the next 5 years of how their economy would go, how fast the growth rates would be, what their fiscal deficits would look like, what their current account balances, surpluses, or deficits would look like, what their capital accounts would look like in terms of reserve accumulation and again, capital account surplus versus deficits. And then the fund is meant to put those all together, the 19 countries' five-year projections together, and analyze the compatibility and consistency, what's called collective consistency of those scenarios. Does 85% of the world economy do the current account deficits and surpluses add up?
Mm-hmm.
Do they both complement each other, and do the surpluses on current and capital account balance off each other? And what does the growth rates look like, and where could stimulus come from, and where is contraction needed, and does the stimulus offset the contraction? So you force a long-term view of how are we going to get to where we want to be in 5 years, where the U.S. and the China are not the linchpins and center of the world economy. How do we get to a place where the U.S. can correct its imbalance by contracting, and the Chinese can offset it by expanding? But what I'm suggesting is that play is looking very difficult to pull off in Seoul, for sure. So somehow one has to formulate an alternative play over the long term, in which other surplus and deficit countries, both in fiscal policy and savings investment imbalances, in trade and in capital flows, those are the four elements that you're looking at. How can those be, you know, pushed forward as you look out 5 years? What are the alternative ways in which those 19 G20 countries can adjust their policies in such a way so that other mid-sized members of that group so that it's a pluralistic effort. So you take the heat off the U.S.-China situation and you move forward over the long term to do this. And I think the other piece I would add to that is that you've got to look beyond the macro policies. You've got to look at structural, what the OECD is calling structural reforms. You've got to look at things like pension, how different countries, I mean, you've got riots on the streets of France this week, you know, on pension reform. That needs to be looked at. Healthcare issues are drowning public budgets everywhere. So labor markets and financial markets and services sector, there's a new way of rethinking regulation. It seems like we've got to do more regulation in the financial sector. The OECD is suggesting in its Go Growth outlook that there should be a greater liberalization or deregulation in the services sector as one source of structural reform, and where it could lead to higher growth, and to focus on productivity change over the long term by stimulating research and development, higher education, science and technology, and trying to boost productivity growth as the foundational element in economic growth. So I think the G20 has work to do together among the leaders and finance ministers and central bank presidents for sure, but among the leaders to sort of not only it is to shape a policy and a process within the G20 over the long term, and then give a strong and concerted commitment to that, which means agreeing to peer review, agreeing to adjust your policies in relation to the scenarios that are being put forward over the 5 years to get to where we need to get to, including the big countries like the U.S. and China. And then only, secondarily, the discussions we had with Alan Beatty in Seoul, is you don't decide the message and then try to think that you're going to drive the policy by doing the message, but then you get the leaders to agree to that message, and then you get clear, you make a very clear message to markets and the public that we have a commitment on the part of all the leaders to a process over the medium term to correct these imbalances, that we have an agreement among leaders that this needs to be focused on all economic policies, not just macro policies, that it needs to be focused on all the G20s, not just the U.S. and China, and that it's a cooperative, long-term, tedious process that takes patience, but that we all understand that we have to do it, because if we don't, we have a global disaster on our hands, not because there's the disagreement in Seoul, if there is one, is not a disaster because of a political disaster, it's an economic disaster. So if leaders are aware that they must deal with this, that they can't do it alone, they can only do it together, and they actually make a commitment to the process, not just worry about what the communique says, but make a commitment to the process and make it work, submit good projections. The first round on this, they submitted, I'm told, shoddy, I haven't looked at them, shoddy, you know, really sloppy, you know, just they just did back of the hand, you know, they didn't give the IMF serious data. They need to give them serious data. There need to be meetings at the technical level about it to work it out and tee it up for ministers, and then ministers need to tee it up for leaders, and leaders have to be willing to say, whoops, you know, it looks like we wanted to do this for go this way and path A for domestic reasons, but now we've got international pressure that makes it clear to us not two things. One is that in order to have global adjustment down the road, we have to adjust too. And second of all, the other big lesson out of this, it's very clear from economics, is that if everybody works together, everybody has to adjust less, take painful adjustment less. If everybody says, screw you, I'm going to contract because I've got a debt-GDP ratio that's too high.
Right.
I just have to deal with it myself. I can't worry about the rest of you, which is sort of the position of some countries that have been taking. I mean, that maybe exaggerates it a little bit, but to say you have to contract no matter what. But the fact is that you have to contract a lot less if other countries are expanding and you agree to contract a little bit less than you would have, then you add a stimulus that otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have, you lessen your own dampening impact on the economy because you know that others are stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to receive, these are, they're multiplier effects here.
Right.
And they work going, they work to multiply, to grow faster, but they also work in the danger we have now is that if everybody contracts, of course, that has multiplier effects going down. That spirals downward. That's a vicious circle going downward. So what you want to try to do is have enough of the major players in the world doing expansionary policies to have multiplier effects going upwards that countervail the contractionary effects that other economies are doing necessarily to move to fiscal consolidation, which countries have to do after all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a convincing realpolitik argument here that this isn't just some kind of idealistic, utopian, you know, oh, we must cooperate sort of scenario. This is real economics, where the fact is that you do have to do less painful adjustment if everybody else is on the same page and everybody's trying to adjust together, and you use, you know, the countries with fiscal policy space, with current account surpluses, with huge reserve accumulations, which is not just China. You know, there are OPEC countries, there are countries in the Middle East, there's Germany, there's Japan. Several countries have reserve accumulations. So you use that space, but those countries too benefit from the fact that other countries don't have to contract so much because their exports will rise and their economies will grow faster because of their contributions to stimulating global growth and softening the downturn in those countries that have to consolidate their balances. So I think there's a definite argument to be made here, but the argument is, you know, Alan Beatty and the other guys in the press, I mean, I organized this conference and this symposium in Korea, and one of the key things I wanted to do there was to bring out the importance of communications mm-hmm. for leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way I put it is, you can't lead if you're not seen to lead, and you can't be seen to lead without the press. I felt like the Financial Times had played up the conflict in the run-up to the London and the Toronto summit too much, so I took Alan to task on it, and others at the FT, as a matter of fact.
Sure.
And we ended up with a dialogue back and forth, which then led to you know, my organizing this session in Seoul and asking the Financial Times to send someone, and they picked Alan Dessen, who was absolutely the right guy. And he'd been with us in April when we had an exploratory conference on this whole set of issues for the Koreans with Chung Yong Ri, with the Sherpa for the G20. So, you know, we ran this one down, and the journalists, to their credit, pushed back and said, "Look, you don't want the tag wagging the dog here. You don't. Yes, we understand you can't lead without" being seen to lead, and that we play a crucial role, but we can't tell good stories to make it happen, and you don't want the leaders and the people around them to saying, look, this is the message we need to give, so let's give the message.
Mm-hmm.
What you need is, as Paul Bluestein, Thomas Mann from Brookings, actually, domestic politics guy at Brookings, who began his intervention in this session with the journalists by saying, why am I here? And the reason he's here is because all of this has to do with domestic politics, and all the domestic politics is being driven by job loss.
Yeah, exactly.
In both China and in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Exactly.
So, you know, the reason why, you know, you've got a Tea Party movement in the U.S. is because people are angry because they've lost their jobs, they've lost their pension income, they've lost their security. And so, you know, it's vital that the corrective policy. So Tom Mann said, you know, the policies have to be credible. There's no substitute for getting the policies right. You have to do that first. And Alan said, don't overstretch the narrative. And you can't get the message out ahead of where the real policy story is. And Paul Bluestein, who's a former Washington Post guy, said, bad news is good news. The fact is that if the press does bad news, it forces officials to generate the good news. their action. He said that the role of journalists is to be action forcers before, during, and after summits. All that pushback by the journalists on the critique that I made, I think, was valid. And so the point I'm trying to get at here is that what you need is serious policy commitment within the G20 community. And even if they're not able to do a lot in Seoul right now, if the Koreans can push the other G20 members to say, look, we've got a conundrum at the moment that we can't solve now, mm-hmm. but we can't just leave it on the table, turn our backs and leave and say, oh, well, there's nothing to be done. We have to, this shows that it only can be done over time, and it only can be done if we all do it together, and it can only be done with taking a very comprehensive, holistic view of the situation, including structural reform policies, productivity change, investment in human capital, all those kinds of things, in addition to the macro policies. That's the only way we can do it. And if they decide that, and we have to commit to the G20 peer review process in the framework of strong, sustainable, and balanced growth over the five-year period. And so what we do is we say in France, a year from now, we're committing now to being in a better place and to having a better pathway plan and trajectory and pathway forward than we've got at the moment. We commit ourselves to generating that, and we commit ourselves to honest exchange of views and adjustment of our own policies to make that path feasible. And that's the message coming out, but it's only a message that can be there if the leaders mean it.
Great. No, thank you. And I think the combination of policy and business observers here in the room, you'll find a lot of agreement among those here at the table. Colin, since we have 20 minutes, could we open it up to the table and
yes, please.
Have some questions? Thank you.
Yeah, sorry to go on so long, actually.
Oh, no. The points are very wonderful. Anyone, please.
Hi, it's Henry Segerman, International Investment Advisors. How are you today? Thank you for your comments.
Yes, you mentioned it at the beginning. Thank you.
You didn't mention Korea very much, and so I'm not going to either. But I do want to ask you historical economics question about what deleveraging is. And let me explain what I mean by my question.
Okay.
2 years ago, the CDS market was estimated to be $64 trillion, and Lehman Brothers went bankrupt because its book was levered 33-1. It can be assumed that the rest of the $64 trillion in CDS coverage was similarly not 33-1, but was highly, highly levered. And so most of the economists who were commenting on the financial crisis said that, oh, now we must enter this period of deleveraging. Mm-hmm. We sort of look back. Everybody started immediately talking about the Japan's lost decade, and during which time, at the beginning of which, you know, the Nikkei was trading at 39,000. And that was completely unsustainable. 10 years later, it was trading at 12,000, and really, you know, has not reflated measurably.
Not recovered.
Likewise, the NASDAQ, which was trading at I've forgotten already 5,000 10 years ago, has not gotten anywhere near that level. So that was a kind of deleveraging or deflation of mispriced assets.
Right.
So what happened in the what are called the HICS? Have you heard this term, HICS?
Highly indebted countries.
Highly indebted industrialized countries is that the central banks and the Federal Reserves in these various countries bailed out to all of the financial institutions, including AIG, which essentially was, you know, the kind of the backbone to all of these levered assets, stimulated the economy with about $1 trillion and promising even more in this country. In Western Europe, same story. I mean, do you think that – are we really talking – over the past 2 years, is what's going on, is what has happened been in actually a displacement of leverage as opposed to actual deleveraging? And are we in for a longer period of deleveraging, perhaps as long as 10 years, before the displaced leverage that went from the private sector onto the taxpayer is worked through? The reason I ask this question is because it sounds like the argument you are making is that we need more Keynesian stimulus, and you know, with that, you know, more bank stabilization maneuvers and so forth and so on. You know, are we postponing the inevitable? I hate to be so gloomy, but I thought perhaps since you have a PhD in economics and I don't, that you could tell me what deleveraging is.
Well, I'm not a financial economist, but I've certainly been around a lot of them over the last 2 years as we've, you know, because clearly the whole thing that went awry here, of course, was the relationship between the financial economy and the real economy being incomes, jobs, economic growth of GDP on the one hand, and the financial markets and financial institutions on the other. And so what I would say, Henry, is which, I mean, maybe it's realism rather than either pessimism or optimism, is that I think that, you know, I think that the world has learned that over-leveraging is really a cause of financial bubbles that you mentioned, where, you know, where stock markets and housing markets and commodity markets, for that matter, get overpriced. I mean, in a way, the speculative aspects of the financial system have meant that the dictum that, you know, that market prices reflect real scarcities and our equilibrium prices are actually wrong. I mean, you know, anybody who thinks that the real price of carbon today is the one that we've got, or that the real price of money today is the ones that we have, are just, you know, just clear that market, because of this sort of disequilibrium in the financial markets, that it's distorting prices in the real economy. And so you do have these breaks where, you know, over the last 40 years, we've had, you know, an oil shock, an interest rate shock, a capital flow shock, and now a financial market shock, you know, over the last 40 years. So the global economy has been very unstable. And I think the reason is that, you know, the financial side of the global economy has inflicted shocks on the real side. So what's the way out of this? The Basel III thing, all the stuff that will get discussed in Korea. And I think that's another thing that Korea can do with the, you know, in the summit in Seoul in November, is to say, look, there's more to what the G20 is doing than just macroeconomic policy coordination. There is also a financial regulatory story that is ready to roll out as a result of the Basel work, and be affirmed by leaders in Seoul. I think where I share a view with you is that I think we're in for a long period now of modest, steady, more modest, steadier growth, because the financial system is being put in a bit of a harness, which probably is necessary. I mean, I think the public is saying, you know, who's taking responsibility for this? There's the trouble with the Anglo-Saxon version of global capitalism is that it's a hands-off version of capitalism, and we need a public hand in the story. Somebody needs to take responsibility for this, and so I think I don't think the regulatory reforms coming out of Basel III, out of Basel from the from the FSB are excessive. I'm hoping that it's sufficient. And I think it will mean, though, that there will be less room for speculation. There will be less room for big profits. There'll be less growth, but it'll be steadier. And I think the public, if you ask the public in a Gallup poll around the world, would you rather have boom, bust, high growth, slump cycles in the future, or would you rather have modest, steadier growth over the future? I'd be very surprised if a very substantial majority of world public opinion wouldn't say we'll take slower, steadier, thank you. And that's a good thing. I mean, you know, people have to plan their lifetimes and their pensions. And if they have to settle for lower growth rates, but knowing that when they get to be 70, they've got a certain amount of income and they can count on that rather than having it swiped away from them by financial collapse, I think it's rational. And I think that both the private sector and the public sector leaders need to take this on board and say, okay, you know, we all loved it when we could play casino capitalism, but, you know, I myself can remember I bought Tootsie Roll once on Monday and sold it on Friday, and I made a nice profit. Well, that's terrific, but this isn't Las Vegas, right? And, you know, it's just, that's, you know, great, good. It's a great game, but not when it generates the kind of disaster that this has generated for the global public. I mean, it's just, somebody's got to take charge of this, and I think the G20 is the group to do it.
Great. Thank you.
Josetta Capriati, I'm in the public relations business. I am Italian, Dr. Bradford, and I would like to remind you and everybody else.
Splendido.
And in fact, today they gave us panettone here for breakfast, which is the Italian Christmas cake.
In New York.
I would like to remind you and everybody that it was the Italian Prime Minister in 2001 in the G8 summit of Genova in 2001 to first launch the idea of expanding the G8 summit to the G20 summit. In any case, my question is...
Who was that Prime Minister? Was that Amata?
Silvio Berlusconi. No, my dear. Silvio Berlusconi. Who is still our beloved Prime Minister.
Yes, right.
Yes. Now, my question is, in spite of the results of the summit, in view of all the problems that you have so cleverly outlined and in such depth, what do you think, just the simple fact of having the summit in Seoul, how will that affect Korea's position in Asia from a political point of view? Thank you.
Yeah, good question. To be honest with you, I wish Mr. Berlusconi had been as forthright about his commitment to an expanded G8 in the L'Aquila summit as he had been in 2001, as you suggest. But anyway, that's another story. I think your more serious question is I think Korea has impressed the world already with its seriousness and attempts to play a leadership role on behalf of the whole world. They've done that in part by the way they've been organizing the summit, but they've done it also in part by insisting and getting the G20 already to agree to have development of developing countries be on the G20 agenda. That has already been agreed to. There's a working group doing it. The French have already said they will take it up next year and carry it forward. There's been a lot of thinking about that. We ourselves at Brookings and other places have contributed to that thinking. The Koreans have reached out to developing countries to get their views, of course, and engage them in the whole process so that the G20 is not seen as doing something for the developing world, but doing something with it. And so that brings to the rest, and there's been a lot of talk that this whole framework for strong, sustainable, and balanced growth should include that the development of developing countries should be included in that as part of the grand strategic design and the way out of the mess, but also the way out of making sure that as we get out of the mess, we're not just arranging it among the 20, but are integrating and including the rest of the world into the whole game plan. So I think I'm sure that there are some resistances going on within Asia. I don't know this for a fact, but I can see how, you know, when you have a younger, smaller member of a regional community who's suddenly a power, and there's no doubt in my mind but what Korea is a power. Rising as fast as it has and having the kind of capacity that it has, both and on many dimensions, just not economic capacity, but leadership capacity. And that, you know, her neighbors, Japan and China, maybe particularly, are thinking, whoa, who do they think they are? Well, let's see what's going on. But on the other hand, I think a more mature way to go about it is to realize that Korea, you know, one of the things that I've argued for a long time is a real asset for the G20, and I think we touched on this at the last breakfast, is that the middle there, a lot of people think it's a large grouping. Some people think it's too large, but it's a large grouping, and the benefits of that are that you do have countries like Korea, and I would mention Canada and Australia, just as two examples, three examples of countries that are not large, but who act on behalf of more than themselves in the world, and who are respected because of that. I mean, the Canadians are 30 million people. I mean, it's not that many people. It's a huge landmass, but it's not that many people. So a lot of people could say, well, why do you want Canada in the G20? Well, the reason you want Canada in the G20, we wouldn't have a G20 today if it wasn't for Canada. I'm convinced of it. And the reason is that Canada, over my professional lifetime, ever since Pierre Trudeau has, you know, and before that, has been a highly multilateralist country and has conducted its foreign policy in behalf of not only itself, but its neighbors, its the regions in which it's involved, like the Caribbean, the Commonwealth countries, and so on. So it's been known over decades as being a multilateralist country that takes into account the interests of other people. I think Korea's launched itself in exactly that same tradition, and Australia does as well, so that, you know, you don't have to be big to be influential. And I think, you know, Korea, if you conduct yourself in a way that includes the interests and views and perspectives of others, and I think Korea's been doing that. I think it's respected around the world. You can't help it. The Koreans I know are just wonderfully serious people. I mean, it's just a delight to go there. I made the remark several times that if all the G20 countries took the G20 as seriously as Korea does these problems, we would have the G20 that we want. But not all countries are doing that, and that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Dr. Bradford.
Getting close to the time when I'm going to have to go, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, this will be our last question. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. This is Che Hyun Shin, consul at the Korean Consulate General here in New York, speaking.
Oh, good.
Yes, thanks for the in-depth and informative explanation this morning, and I really appreciate that. And actually, as you touched upon, Korea has a unique position in hosting this third G20 summit as a country which has developed from a developing country into one of the 11 largest economies in the world.
Right.
And in addition to the basic agendas like the ensuring a global economy recovery framework for strong, sustainable, and balanced growth, and thirdly, strengthening the international financial regulation system, and fourth, modernizing the international financial institutions. The Korean government has been very much active in promoting three major issues. One is, as you pointed out during the answer to my previous colleague's question, that is development issue. And then secondly, in promoting a global financial safety net, which is meant for ensuring the assist many emerging and developing countries to ensure their self-insurance and also deal with capital flow volatility, financial fragility, and prevent crisis contagion. And thirdly, Korea is also aiming at promoting the more active participation of the private sectors. And having this in mind, Korea is trying to host the Seoul G20 Business Summit. And having said that, actually, I'd like to ask you on the very holy question, that is, this morning's the subtitle is Korea as a convener and innovative economy, and I'd like to ask you what kind of innovative role and approaches or initiatives you expect the Korean government or Korea to take taking advantage of this third summit. Thank you.
Right. Good question. I'll tell you what I'd like you to do if you'd like a longer answer on this, is just email me at cbradford at brookings.edu. Stephen can give you the email address, and I will give you much more detail on this. I have to leave to take my wife to a bus, actually. So I can't be late. There are a number of things. The Business Summit is one. They did have a meeting with non-G20 countries on the financial regulatory issue. They are reaching out to regional summits. There's a discussion about whether to have a secretariat to help systematize the incorporation of views from the rest of the world into the G20 summits. There are a number of other ways in which they are doing this. I can send you a list. So if you send me an email, I'll give you a list. But those are the three: the regional summits, the having meetings with non-G20 countries, a secretariat to systematize incorporation of views, setting aside time within the summits to listen to views from countries that aren't there, not just from them, but also have them incorporated into the agenda. So there are ways of having non-G20 countries be involved without having them sitting at the table.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm very sorry to have to leave.
Thank you, Dr. Bradford, and we look forward to welcoming you here in the new year and getting your perspectives, having been in Seoul, and follow on to the G20. So we look forward to seeing you then in 2011, and we thank you very much for your continued support of this series.
Okay, and I'll see you in Washington. Thank you, everyone.
Kamsahamnida, grazie. Thank you very much.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.